I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm speaking today with Pablo Staffarini. Pablo is working on philosophy at the University of Toronto and a longtime political and philosophical activist of various sorts. He's from Buenos Aires. And welcome, Pablo.
Hi, nice to be with you.
Now, I want to talk to you a little bit later about the Abolitionist Society, which is a project that you and some other utilitarians have started to work on the problem of human suffering. But let's talk first about utilitarianism. You have a long-time interest in utilitarian philosophy. How do you define utilitarianism, and why did you get interested in it?
Well, utilitarianism can be broadly defined as the ethical theory that says that the right, the morally right act, is the one that maximizes net pleasure. Pleasure either conceived in, you know, traditional terms as pleasant sensations, or in the sense of preference satisfaction. So, as regards to my interests in utilitarianism, yes, I've been interested in this ethical theory since my later years in high school. So, yeah, it's been quite a while.
Now, you also have an interest in politics. You have you set up a website on Noam Chomsky's work, as I remember it, and you you consider yourself a bit of a libertarian left thinker.
Right, yeah. The term libertarian is quite tricky. It has one meaning in the United States, which is not exactly the one it had during the 19th century when, theorists and activists like Peter Kropotkin and Bakunin were using the term libertarian to define themselves. So, yeah, you could say that I am a libertarian socialist and clearly siding on the left side of the political spectrum.
And obviously you see connections between the philosophical work of utilitarianism and the libertarian socialism. Can you summarize those connections in a couple sentences?
Yeah, well, nowadays there seems to be a consensus among political philosophers that utilitarianism doesn't actually define a specific political doctrine. Nonetheless, I think that the connection between progressive left-wing thought and utilitarian thinking has been a historical constant throughout the last 200 years. So if you take, for instance, the work of a pioneer in utilitarian thought like William Godwin, he was, a radical, literally an anarchist thinker, and he was also a staunch utilitarian. You move to, Jeremy Bentham, John Stuart Mill, and nowadays Peter Singer, and you see that all these thinkers that are identified as key figures in the history of utilitarian thought are also, to varying degrees leaning on the left. So, yeah, my view is that there's a connection between utilitarian ethics and left-wing politics.
Even though it's theoretically possible to be a utilitarian conservative or a non-utilitarian left-winger?
Yeah, there have been some utilitarian conservatives out there, yes.
So this project, the Abolition Society, now you've been involved for a long time in the transhumanist movement, and one of the people who is one of the founders of contemporary transhumanism is a guy named David Pearce, and he's one of the co-founders of the Abolitionist Society with you. His Hedonist Manifesto, is that one of the inspirations for the idea behind the Abolitionist Society?
Oh, sure, yes. I think there's a direct connection between Dave's pioneering work on what he calls paradise engineering or the abolitionist project and the abolitionist society that, although it was technically founded by me, Dave, and Sean Henderson, it credit should be given mostly to Sean, who has been really active with this project since its foundation in 2002.
So the idea behind the Hedonist Manifesto and the Abolitionist Society is that we are neurophysiologically, or that our experience of suffering is neurophysiological. And so that part of the answer, the utilitarian answer, or the hedonist answer to human suffering is not only to change the material conditions that people live under or the ways that they think about their lives, but also actually to change their brains themselves.
Sure. I mean, if you are really serious about improving the condition for humans and non-human creatures, you really want to hand down the causes of their current plight to its, you know, to its real origins. And although there's a case to be made for the view that, you know, most of the things that are wrong in this world actually come from bad choices of people, well, those choices are themselves caused by some conditions that are part of human nature. So, you know, there's the conflict of interests arises only because we have some particular constitution, and that has to takes account for the fact that the conflict arises in the first place. So, yeah, that's basically the answer, although, of course, more detail could be given.
Well, let's get into that. I mean, by the way, I'm speaking with Pablo Staffarini. He's one of the principal organizers of the Abolitionist Society and a longtime transhumanist and left and utilitarian thinker and activist. The conflict or the trade-off that you allude to there is the trade-off that many people would see between a brave new world kind of society where free drugs that made people happy were available and any kind of motivation on the part of citizens in that kind of a society to improve either their lives or the intolerable conditions they might be living under. So in other words, don't you think that citizens who were made happy simply with a chemical change to their brain would be more passive and more tolerant of intolerable things?
Right. Of course, what you are, you know, mentioning here has been a constant source of unease among many people who would otherwise be sympathetic to the project. But personally, and I know Dave and others share my view on these things, on this topic, I think, you know, the Brave New World image is completely misguided. I mean, if anything, to just mention the particular source of objection that you have just alluded to, this notion that we would be more vulnerable to political tyrants by being made more happy by the help of either, you know, pharmacological tools or direct genetic engineering is actually the opposite seems to be the case. I mean, there's a correlation between depression and submission to authority. So expectedly, you know, making people more happy would also empower them and give them tools to resist this kind of tyranny.
I think that's a very powerful argument. I mean, one of the reasons why antidepressants seem to have, at least at the beginning, an uptick in suicidal behavior is because people are too passive to even kill themselves when they're really depressed.
Right.
So at that end, obviously, you give people more energy. But at the other end, there seems to be a difference or a distinction that we could make, and it's one that John Stuart Mill seems to have made, between an empowering, dynamic, active kind of happiness and engagement with one's life and optimism that would give people energy, and a bliss-out, passive bliss-out that would make people totally unable to do anything in their lives except be, you know, fixated on having more of that bliss. Do you make that kind of distinction?
Yeah, as Dave says in one of his interviews, to be blissed is not to be blissed out. So we usually associate the, you know, false comfort, you know, typically depicted in a novel like Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. We tend to associate that with the abolitionist project, but, you know, again, I think the opposite is the case. What we are advocating here is a form of genuine, deep, really enriching form of experience, which is the opposite of the dull, passive, submissive existence that people led in Huxley's novel.
There seems to be two powerful arguments for why achieving a happier life or a happier society would have to be neurophysiological. Let me run them past you. The first is that there seems to be strong evidence that we all have hedonic set points or happiness set points that we return to regardless of our life experiences. And so just by the genetic crapshoot, what you have at birth, you're either a grouchy person or a happy person. And it doesn't seem any logical reason why we would not want to all move our settings, our happiness set points, up to the top of that range, that possible range. And the second that I'd like you to comment on is the idea of a hedonic treadmill, that because we set expectations for ourselves and achieve them and then get bored with them and then set more expectations, after about $10,000 of income, it doesn't appear like there's any benefit to actually changing people's material conditions around the world. The wealthy people are just as unhappy. Well, actually, there is still a slight correlation between wealth and happiness, because there's a correlation with health and happiness. But in general, the bang you get for in changing people's material conditions tapers off after about $10,000 a year in income.
Yeah.
So those two things would seem to argue that we should really be focusing at least part of our attention on this biological basis.
Yeah, to take the second point that you have just made, the hedonic treadmill, I think the expression was originally made by a psychologist named Richard Eysenck. But at any rate, this is actually the case, and there have been some studies confirming this hypothesis. And as you said, people say winning the lottery are just happier than the average person, and certainly happier than they were before winning the lottery for a period of at most 6 months, and then they go back to their original normal level of well-being. So, if you really want to take seriously the results of contemporary science and inform your ethical and political views with current views about the nature of the world and the nature of ourselves, then of course you want to design a society in which that people do not waste their time pursuing these kinds of projects that will ultimately be self-defeating. Rather, we should be organizing our way of existence in a way that accounts for these facts and tries to maximize as long as we are not willing to change our constitution, well, you should at least be aiming to organize yourself in a more rational manner. Now, if you really want to transcend your limitations and overcome this hedonic treadmill, then the only option is to pursue the genetic engineering way, which is altering our nature at the level of genes and just abolish this tendency to become satisfied with our lot after a brief period of time, and design the human constitution in order for it to allow for unlimited prolonged states of bliss.
The project has obvious connections to the debate over drug policy reform, but
right.
On the other hand, it's not as if taking heroin actually makes you happier overall. We wouldn't be advocating for general drug dependency on something like heroin as a way to achieve hedonic satisfaction. So this is why we might talk more about changing the constitution of the brain itself, right?
There are different types of drugs. You have like an opioid like heroin, which certainly doesn't really make you happy or happy in the sense that we are talking, in the relevant sense. But you have like other drugs, MDMA, like a drug like an opioid like the heroin, does give you the sort of a pleasurable experience that I think we, Dave, and the rest of us have in mind. Although it's just for a brief moment and probably much less intense that we could achieve if we directly intervened in the human genome. But you know, there are many problems with this path, and you have just mentioned one, which is the hedonic treadmill. I mean, if you could design a drug that, in theory, could generate an everlasting sense of well-being, this hedonic treadmill will make this project impossible. You couldn't achieve this result in a creature like a human creature. So, if you really want to, again, if you really want to induce, permanent feelings of well-being and abolish suffering altogether, then the only way is to, intervene in the human genome.
The Buddhist in me raises other questions, and the Buddhist diagnosis is that the nature of the dissatisfactoriness of life, it comes from desire and attachment. And there's a nihilistic approach to that, which is to say the only way that we could ever really get rid of suffering would be to get rid of all desire, and then we wouldn't have a hedonic treadmill because we wouldn't be walking on the treadmill anymore.
Right.
And there's the more kind of dynamic Buddhist answer, which is that there might be some way to approach life so that you can remain unattached, but in the same way engaged, and not focus on bad things and focus on good things and so on. So, that would be a kind of a different approach than jacking up the endorphins in the brain so that we feel like we've just taken a good hit of opiates.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think these views, for all the insight that they contain, they're fundamentally misguided insofar as they conceive of pleasure and pain as ultimately intentional in character. That is, the creation of pleasure or the frustration of, sorry, the existence of pleasure and pain are actually there because of the frustration of a desire. So, you have like two ways here. We may call it the Eastern way and the Western way. The Eastern way, says, okay, what you want to do is to get rid of your desires, and then you would get rid of your suffering. Well, whereas the more Western way would say, no, what you want to do is to, change the circumstances so that you get the objects of your desire, and then you wouldn't be in this state of suffering. Well, both these approaches are wrong in my view, because this intentional nature of pleasure is something that is built upon us by evolution. So there's nothing incoherent in the notion of being perpetually blissed without having an object, without that pleasure, that sublime state, being directed to something outside ourselves.
Listen to the waves against the rocks. I don't know where they've been. I'm waiting for the sky to open up and let the happiness in. Let the happiness in. Let the happiness in, 'cause it's coming.
This is Jay Hughes, Change Surfer Radio. I'm speaking with Pablo Staffarini. Pablo is one of the principal organizers of the abolitionist-society.com, or Abolitionist Society, which has the goal of eliminating human suffering. So do not aim low. And by the way, there is a connection also to Buddhism there, because one of the vows of the bodhisattva, of the person who tries to achieve enlightenment, is that you will also eliminate all human suffering. So
right.
You've basically taken the bodhisattva vow and taken it in a slightly different direction. Okay, two more ordinary philosophical challenges that have been anticipated for thousands of years, but have to be addressed. One is that there may be a trade-off between intelligence and happiness, in the sense that John Stuart Mill says that I would rather be a man dissatisfied than a pig satisfied. And so that the more complex our minds become, the more subtle the kinds of things that we appreciate. We can no longer be happy just with NASCAR and fried chicken. We have to have, you know, caviar and fine white wine or something. That's one kind of challenge. The other kind of challenge is that there seems to be substantial evidence that happiness, our ordinary kind of daily happiness, comes partly from self-delusion. And that, in fact, depressive people are the most honest with themselves about the nature of their lives, and that the happy people are the ones who are able to forget about and ignore all the bad things and focus on the good things in their lives. So let's take those two. Are there trade-offs between happiness and honesty and happiness and intelligence?
Right. Well, of course, a full response to these challenges would take us beyond the limits of this conversation. But roughly, I think that the first challenge, whether we seem to prefer the life of a Socrates dissatisfied than the life of a pig satisfied, as Mill put it. Again, I would say that that's just contingent on the way we are, and there's no natural law, certainly, that precludes the possibility of creating super beings who are both super intelligent and and enjoy extraordinary levels of well-being. It might be true that given our current constitution, then the more intelligent you are, the less prone you are to find sources of gratification in trivial things. But again, that's part of maybe the intentional nature of pleasure in a redefined in a post-human society, presumably these creatures would not be directed to external sources of pleasure, but they would be genetically pre-programmed to enjoy sublime levels of well-being, irrespective of the object of their satisfaction. So that's the short answer to the first challenge. The second challenge was about honesty, and yes, as you mentioned, there's been some studies that show that the more honest you are, the statistically the more depressed that you tend to be, and I think I experienced that personally. I mean, if we look upon our own lives, we find that in many occasions, deceiving ourselves slightly make us tolerate a situation that we would otherwise find quite displeasing. But again, I don't really see why. I see that as a tendency selected by evolution, because as a cognitive reduction strategy. But I don't think that we would expect, again, beings that are designed by humans in anticipation of their consequences and not by evolution, by a blind process of selection. I don't see why we would find the same correlation between honesty and ill being.
That's just to bring it back to politics for a second. You reminded me that Antonio Gramsci's famous dictum was that the revolutionary needed to have pessimism of the intellect and optimism of the will. And so combining those two kinds of analysis and at the same time an optimistic ability to look past how bleak the situation might be. Another thing would be Emma Goldman's dictum that if I can't dance at your revolution, I don't want to be part of it. And,
right.
What you seem to be suggesting is that if there is, in fact, a connection between political reformism or democratic citizen empowerment of whatever kind, whether it's left or right wing, and optimism and happiness, that insofar as we begin to create citizens who are happier and happier, that we may be empowering them to be more and more radical in their demands for social reform.
Yeah, that might actually be the case. Of course, it's still, I think, an open question.
What do you think the future for this abolitionist society project is? You and Sean and David, what directions do you want to go with it?
Personally, I think the abolitionist project may play a minor role in bringing about this future that we are advocating. My own view is that it might trigger an initial process, but the main changes in our nature will result from prospective parents making reproductive decisions. So, you know, the more the reproductive techniques are improved, then the more power prospective parents will have to choose the genetic constitution of their future children. And so, since in general, although not in all cases, but in general, they will tend to select for children that, you know, have a predisposition for happiness, then, you know, it is to be expected that, you know, by a long process of such decisions, a cumulative process, the type of, you know, creature, you know, human constitution that we are envisioning will eventually materialize. But that's, of course, you know, a speculation. There are some skeptics out there, like Steven Pinker, who wrote an article on the myth of the designer baby. There are certainly arguments, you know, to be considered that say that what we could achieve by this, you know, by making reproductive decisions is very limited. So if that's the case, then the role that might be played by the abolitionist society and, you know, a website like Davis Maintaining should be much more important. Whether we will succeed or not, that's, of course, a different question. But it all depends on whether the goals could be achieved by, you know, a conscious decision on the part of the whole species, or whether individual members, by pursuing their own interests and the interests of their progeny, could actually, you know, bring about the type of change that we have in mind.
Pablo, I really want to thank you for joining us. You can find out more about Pablo's project, the Abolitionist Society, at abolitionist-society.com. And David Pierce's website is Hedweb, HEDWEB.com. And you can read there his Hedonist Manifesto, which lays out some of the background of this and many thousands and thousands of links to drug information and other information about the way the brain works and happiness. So thanks again for joining us, Pablo.
Oh, glad to be here.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies, and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IEET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IEET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@IEET.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at IEET.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to the Infos Radio Project at the Change Surfer website at changesurfer.com. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.